My name is Sean, and I'm an alcoholic.
All right.
Well, that's the end of the facts. All the rest of this stuff is my opinion, and I'm not an expert on alcoholism, and I'm certainly not a spokesman for Alcoholics Anonymous. But I do have some opinions. Isn't this neat? Looks like a drunk designed this. If one's good, three will be better.
Yeah.
I'm a member of the White Cliff group that meets Wednesday nights in Horseshoe Bay in West Vancouver, British Columbia, and is one of the two best groups in the world. And I understand you might know of the other one. I'm also proud to be an AA sponsor for the Keep the Dream Alive Alateen group that meets Monday nights in West Vancouver. And they say there are no big deals in Alcoholics Anonymous. Like, I gotta tell you something, this is a big deal, yeah. I want to thank the committee for asking us to be here. We got a real nice hotel room. I mean, not the kind of hotel rooms I used to come to in. You know, really nice. Really nice, and everybody's been just spiffy. It's just great, you know? I took a shower before I came here. I've never been drunk in these clothes. That may not mean a hell of a lot to you, but it means a big thing to me, you know? I wish I had a clue what I was going to talk about. Alcoholics Anonymous is a tribe, and it's a classic tribe in the anthropological sense, insofar as a small group of people come together to protect each other from what they consider to be a hostile environment, a hostile wilderness, and that was certainly true in the beginning. 50 years ago when this thing started here in Canada, there were very small groups and very, very fragile. And in a small tribe, everyone who comes into the tribe is useful. Everyone has a job. And that's the incredible thing about Alcoholics Anonymous is those of us who have been thrown away by the rest of the world come here, come out of the wilderness into the firelight, and we're immediately given jobs. And there are some extraordinary people in the tribe. They're the wise people, the elders. And what they do is they share their experience with us so that we can slowly recover. And the tribe has no written history, really. It's all oral. And what we do is we tell stories to each other. They're the people who keep the fires alive and burning so that those of us out in the wilderness can find them. They're the ones who come and put on the coffee 3 hours before the meeting. They're the ones who bring the cookies and the sandwiches. Because they're the ones that understand that some of us who may be dressed in expensive sport coats may not be eating. There are the mothers and the fathers in the tribe, and they can hardly wait for the babies to come in from the wilderness. And they nurture them and they care for them and they teach them the things of the tribe, the wisdom of the tribe. There are the warriors, and the warriors protect the tribe. They're the GSRs and the DCMs and the delegates who preserve the traditions of the tribe so that the people who come after the original ones will understand what it means. And there are the scouts. They're the ones who go to other tribes through the wilderness and come back and tell us it's safe out there. They're like us. They talk like us. And it'll be okay if you have to go. And so what you find in this tribe called Alcoholics Anonymous is you find other tribes in Fort Worth, Texas, San Diego, California, West Vancouver, British Columbia, in Montreal, in Hagerstown, Pennsylvania, in Las Vegas, in Florida, in Rome, in London, in Paris, in Puerto Vallarta, Mexico. We're all there. And on most nights we gather together to tell each other our stories. But occasionally what happens, and what you are, the scouts this time, you'll go back and you'll tell your groups that it was like just a bigger gathering than our usual tribe. And sometimes when all the tribes get together, they have a festival like this. They have a celebration like this. And some of us in the tribe occasionally are given the job of being the storytellers. And that's my job tonight. I only have one story. It's mine. And so I'm here to share it with you to the best of my ability. And what I would ask all you other members of this great tribe is, if you judge me tonight, be kind. I just have my own story. But I want to tell you about four babies who were born 50 years ago. One was born in the eastern part of Canada. Another was born in the prairies. A third one was born in Latvia, in Europe, in war-torn Europe. And I was born in Victoria, British Columbia. And by the time we had reached the age of about 14 or 15, we had come together and become friends. And I want to describe to you how we were. One of the guys was Danny O'Brien. Danny O'Brien was from the prairies, and his family had moved to Victoria. He was a big, good-looking Irish guy. He had wide shoulders and narrow hips. I had narrow shoulders and wide hips. Danny O'Brien was tough, but he wrote poetry and was one of the most wonderful artists I'd ever seen. And he had a separation between his two front teeth, and he could stick a toothpick in it and talk at the same time. And I wanted to be like Danny. I wanted to be like Danny. He was big and tough, and he was saving to buy a motorcycle. The other guy from Latvia was a little guy named Ivars Lusis. Ivars and Danny worked out together. So he was another one that had the wide shoulders and the narrow hips. Now, I knew that women looked at men in a certain way, even though they weren't supposed to, particularly the St. Anne's Academy girls. But Ivars had the cutest butt I'd ever seen. It was like two little cantaloupes, you know? And he would walk by those girls in those tight jeans, and those girls would check him out. I saw him doing it. I had this big, wide flap behind. And Ivars had a little turned-up nose and a kind of puckish thing going for him. And Ivars could smoke a cigarette and talk at the same time. I never got that down. I always looked like Betty Davis when I smoked. The third guy was Lou Fletcher. Oh, boy. Lou had everything. He was real tall and real thin. And clothes just kind of fit on him like on a hanger. And he looked good. He had white, white Irish skin and black, black hair. And those incredible piercing blue eyes. He had long black eyelashes and thick black eyebrows. They were great eyes, you know. They were kind of those blue eyes with that kind of touch of cruelty in them. He had absolutely perfect teeth. They were perfect. Mine stuck out every which way. Looked like somebody was playing the lost chord on my mouth. And Lou didn't need to drink. Boy, Lou was so cool. Wow, was he cool. He could get those St. Anne's Academy girls to do anything. And he told us about it. And I believed him. And I learned everything I knew about girls from Lou. He had a gold pinky ring on. God, he was cool. I was tall, fat, had thick glasses and crooked teeth, and I was weird. I was the clown of the group. But they tolerated me because I made them laugh. And I was a smart ass and a big mouth. And we got into lots of trouble, particularly when it came time for the dances. See, we all went to a school called St. Louis College. It was a Christian Brothers of Ireland school. It was an all-boys school. So the only activities we were allowed was with the St. Anne's girls. So the dances were a little traumatic, you know? And what you needed to do was, you needed to calm down a little before you got into the dance, you know? So Danny and Ivars and Lou and I would stand outside and we'd pass around a little bottle or something, you know, just kind of calm down and get cool, you know? So that we could walk in and dance with those St. Anne's girls. Whatever else happened. Now, Lou would have a couple of belts. I never understood why. He'd get those girls to do anything. Danny had a couple of belts because it was kind of cool, and Ivars did. I had more than a couple of belts because I was extremely nervous. I'd been raised in an alcoholic home, and I got to tell you, I wish that was the reason why I'm a drunk today. My father was an alcoholic. He was a normal alcoholic home. My father was a drunk and my mother was a saint. And I'd like to pin it on them. I'd like to join one of those little organizations that blames them. But the fact is... The fact is that I'm a drunk because I drank like a pig. That's why I'm a drunk. My father never thought it was a great idea for me to drink a quart of scotch a day. He didn't think it was a great idea for himself to drink a quart of scotch a day. He certainly didn't want his eldest son to do that. Nobody ever recommended that I smoke marijuana or abuse drugs or any of that kind of stuff. Those were all my solutions to my problems. And therefore, my sobriety is my responsibility. It doesn't depend on you. I've got to work the steps. But at any rate, sometimes we didn't go into the dance, you know? Sometimes we were just having so much fun out there plugging that jug and we didn't go in. And also, this was just before the 60s, and we had discovered drugs. We're the generation that made drug abuse middle class. We grabbed it from the hands of black musicians and brought it into the family rooms of America, you know? And what I had discovered was prescription drugs. What Danny and Ivars had discovered was marijuana. And Lou was so cruel, he just tried just for fun, you know? So we would do that. We'd pop all our pills. And what I found out was that I was a really bad drinker. I mean, I used to get drunk very fast on very little. But boy, when I took all that other stuff, I could stay up all night and do it all, you know? When I was about 17 years old, my mother became concerned that I was working too hard during exam time. She gave me one of her diet pills. God bless that woman! What? Opened up a whole new world for me. Now, some of the old-timers don't like us talking about that. To listen to them talk, you hear them. I mean, you think that we messed up a perfectly respectable little disease, you know? I just wonder sometimes if they'd had the same opportunities and the same peer group pressure and the same availability that we had, that they would have said, no, no, no. I prefer to kill myself on my Ripple. You know, give me a break. I've never known a drunk who wasn't a pig. I tried everything and anything that was... I didn't care. As long as it stopped the feelings. As long as it stopped the feeling. Because there wasn't one good thing going on in my life. I was inadequate. I was angry. I was terrified. And I was desperately alone. And I felt like that for years. But something happened the first time I got drunk when I was 14 years old. There was a moment, I don't remember which drink it was, when it all came together. I was Zorba the Greek and Elvis Presley. I was Arnold Schwarzenegger and Fred Astaire. I was Cary Grant and Bruce Willis. I was tough, but sensitive. A scrapper and a poet. Sweet, but just a touch of cruelty. And I was in control, and I gotta tell you something. That happened from the first time I drank till the last time I drank. There was a moment when it happened. When I was everything I needed to be. And that's why I did it. I have never understood anyone who said it stopped working for them. If it had stopped working for me, I'd have stopped doing it. But there was always a second when it all came together. The trouble with it was through the years I paid a higher and higher price for that moment. I sacrificed my morals. I sacrificed money and people. I did anything to achieve that moment. And it happened every time. And finally, the price mounted to such a height, it fell over and crushed me. And I couldn't do it anymore. All I ever wanted out of Victoria was out. That was a one-horse town, and I knew there was something else going on. We had moved to California because my mother had decided it was a new beginning. I don't know about you, but I'm up to my keister in new beginnings. I mean, God, I can't handle another new beginning, you know? And I came back up to Victoria to finish school. When I graduated, I was valedictorian of the class. My father showed up drunk. We all said goodbye, and I got out of that town. I got out of that town as fast as I could. I was 18 years old. I've been drinking for 4 years. I've been taking drugs for a year, and I was in trouble with the chemicals, and I diagnosed myself an alcoholic, and I didn't know I had done it. But I said the phrase that only an alcoholic says, and if you ever said it, you belong in this room. If you've ever heard anybody else say it, they belong in this room. And that phrase is, I can control my drinking. The only people who ever say that phrase are people who need to control their drinking. Social drinkers never deal with that concept. Social drinkers, if they drink and do something stupid, they stop drinking. You ever notice that? Isn't that weird? God! But I started on the great obsession of every abnormal drinker by the time I was 18 years old to control and enjoy my drinking. And let me tell you, when I controlled my drinking, I was miserable. Yeah, just miserable. The only way I liked to drink was, wah! I mean, that's the way I drank, man. Wildly. I was out there naked baying at the moon. I mean, if it ain't like that, why do it? You know, I never sipped anything in my life. I still don't. You should see me drink a cup of coffee. You know? I went to college. Got straight A's. Doing a lot of amphetamines. Calm down. Then I decided at 21 years old that I had a talent the world couldn't live without, and I went to New York. I went to New York with $50 in my pocket, and I saw the skyline of Manhattan, and I said, in 5 years, you're going to know my name. And in 5 years, a lot of people did know my name for a lot of the wrong reasons, but 2 months later, I got my first Broadway show. That's more than a fat, ugly kid from Victoria, British Columbia ever dreamed of. By the time I was 24 years old, I was appearing nightly on one of the largest theaters on Broadway, alone on the stage. The orchestra played a song, and I sang it with a spotlight on my face, and a sold-out house applauded me, and that's more than I ever dreamed of doing or being, and I could hardly wait to maybe see Danny and Ivar's and Lou and let them know that I'd made it. I dropped a whole lot of tonnage, you know. Who wants to shut up long enough to eat lunch when you're dropping those amphetamines? I had my teeth capped, and I had a pair of contact lenses, and shazam! I was good looking. And I like that. There I was on Broadway. And that should have fixed me. But by the time I was 24 years old, I was drinking a quart of scotch a day. I'd picked up a little non-habit forming marijuana habit. And I, and I was working the docks. Not where they bring the ships in. Doctors. See, I think it's stupid to buy drugs in alleys. You can get arrested for that kind of stuff. So what I did was I bought a medical book and memorized symptoms for the kind of drugs I wanted. And I went and talked to the doctors about my symptoms, and they did exactly what they do. They wrote out prescriptions. And I went, I always had three of them, and I went to see all three of them, and, you know, periodically, and got my stuff, you know. It was great. Doctors usually had, doctors have about four and a half hours of classroom time on alcoholics, and then when they're interning, they see drunks being brought into emergency wards from Skid Row, and they think that's what drunks are. I mean, as a class, I mean, probably even more than newcomers, nobody's more ignorant or arrogant about alcoholism than a bunch of doctors. They're just great. They'd much rather we be insane. You know, alcoholism hurts their feelings. They don't like incurable diseases. You know? If you ever talk to your doctor about spiritual principles, his eyes just roll back in his head, you know. So I had a great time. I was the kind of drunk that if you invited me over to your house for dinner, sometime during the evening, I would excuse myself and go to your bathroom, open your medicine cabinet, and take whatever was pretty. Now, depending on what I found in your medicine cabinet, you either have to peel me off the ceiling or get me out of a coma on the bathroom floor, yeah. But I was 24 years old, and I was going to live forever. There had been some news that I wasn't happy about. Ivars had gotten a football scholarship to a terrific university. In the first half of his freshman year, he hanged himself because he couldn't kick a drug and alcohol habit. That's alcoholism. But I knew it would never happen to me. But I was 24 years old, and I was starting to get in trouble that I could perceive. So I decided what I needed to do was... I started on some quest to solve my problems. I went and I went to see a shrink. I entertained him for 8 months. He helped me. He got me down to a fifth of scotch a day, and he gave me a prescription for Valium and Seconal. God bless that man! Woo-hoo-hoo. I don't put down psychiatrists. They're just incapable of helping practicing alcoholics, because I told him exactly what I told the last arresting officer. 2 beers. My wife is an Al-Anon, and she claims that if anybody admits to 3 beers, they're not an alcoholic. I went to see some gurus and did some spiritual literature and microbiotic stuff and all that kind of stuff, and I decided what I needed was a good woman, and I found her in an elevator. And we were going to do a show together, and she was the cutest little thing I ever saw. She was in her leotard the first day of rehearsal, and, oh, God, she's a little blonde with dimples in a leotard. And I looked at her. She couldn't be bothered with me until 3 days later when my back went out and I crawled into rehearsal, and zing went the strings of her heart. I didn't know that for a pre-Al-Anon, a drunk crawling across a hotel lobby was like coming home. Our eyes locked, and she realized at a very deep level that I needed her. I'll never forget the expression on her face when the first, you know, that first moment, you know, when you see each other. It's that terrifying moment when a pre-Al-Anon recognizes potential. Yeah. And I thought, if I get involved with this woman, I'll never get uninvolved, and that's true. We started our dance of death right there and then. And we tangled around the floor a couple of times before we got into AA and Al-Anon. We were in the theater. We had this cute little apartment. Our friends called us the Campbell Soup Kids. We were the cutest kids on the block. We were in the theater. We went to parties. We drank a lot, and it was great, and she drank. A great-looking blonde who drank. Fabulous. We decided to come out to California. As a matter of fact, we came out to California with the show that played in Toronto. It was called Coco with Katharine Hepburn. And we went out to California, and it was another new beginning. I didn't know it was a geographic, but I just knew I had to be in California, and we got married, and she settled down. And one day, we were having cocktails. Cocktails. Oh, aren't you finished with your first drink, dear? Well, you can't drink alone. Let me top mine up. Oh, that's all you want? Well, let me finish that. Oh, well, I can't drink alone. Why don't you just put a little bit more in there? Okay. Oh, well, you don't want that? All right, I'll pop it. Yeah. She took a sip of her drink and she said, "This is boring." She put it down on the coffee table and she never drank again. She didn't go through withdrawals or anything. She just, you know, she wasn't an alcoholic. And then she noticed that I drank. And then the nightmare began, you know. Then we started with, "Don't drink too much at the party tonight," and "Let me drive home," and, you know, all that fun stuff. And broken promises, and every anniversary I promised to cut down on my drinking. She heard that I promised to quit drinking, but I knew I couldn't. I was raised in a large Irish Catholic family, and they were always taking the pledge and giving it up for Lent, and they were always dead drunk 2 weeks later, so it just seemed pointless to me. I decided I was going to drink until I had to do something about it, and that was it. I mean, the arrogance of that is terrifying, but that's what I did. And then the fights began, and those terrible things, and it became the two of us sitting in a house together with her watching me drink. And she was this wonderful little blonde lady with dimples and a feisty sense of humor, a little bit of a foul mouth. She was great. And what I watched her do in that period of 5 years was shrivel before me. The effects of alcoholism on her were devastating. She got to a point, because we had money problems, She would never get her hair done, so she wore her hair in scarves all the time. For the first 6 months in Al-Anon, they never knew if she had hair or not. She wore these shapeless, cheap dresses, and her fingernails were bitten to the quick, and her lips were disappearing. You know how those Al-Anons get? Before they get to Al-Anon. And I kept making promises and breaking them, and it was just nuts. And I was getting to the point where if people didn't know that I drank too much, they thought I was crazy because I was totally erratic. I didn't know what was going on, and I was an actor. And I needed to work. And I didn't work much, and so she got a series of bizarre jobs. And I was a functioning alcoholic. I had a wife who worked. And it would have gone on like that forever, except on April 23rd, 1974, I got arrested by the West Hollywood Vice Squad on a sleazy little charge. I was taken down and fingerprinted and photographed and released on my own recognizance with the front of my pants to the waistband, from the waistband to the knees, soaked in my own urine. And it got my attention. I went home, and she wasn't there. Thank God. She wasn't there. She was down in Orange County saving somebody who didn't need to be saved. I mean, she was just all over the place saving people who didn't need to be saved. And she wasn't there. So there was nobody there to kind of rationalize it and turn it around so it was somehow their fault. I was stuck with what I'd done. And I poured what I hoped to God was my last drink. It was straight vodka in a wine glass with no ice. And that was unusual for me because I had decided a couple of years before that it was hard booze that was the problem. And I had become a wine connoisseur. That's a wino with a checkbook. I have guzzled some of the finest French wines ever made. I mean, hostesses would look in horror. You know, they'd put out a $35 bottle of Chateau Lafite, you know, and I'd take my glass. Excellent bouquet. A lovely color. Yeah. There was nobody there, and I had to deal with it. It wasn't the first time I'd gone to jail, and but I had what I believe was a spiritual experience. I saw very clearly what my life was. I saw that there was this tremendous gap between who I was and who I wanted to be, and I couldn't find any way to bridge that gap. I knew the kind of person I should be. I was raised in a religion. I was raised by good people who had troubles, but they were good people. I have always known the kind of man that I have wanted to be, and I never could make it. Because what had happened through the use and abuse of alcohol and drugs, I was living outside of my own moral beliefs. I was on the other side of my moral beliefs. I came to in strange places with strange people after having done strange things over and over and over again. That's what my life was a series of over and over and over again. I was in constant trouble. I'm the kind of drunk that you find. I'm the kind that doesn't die of anything that looks like alcoholism, you know? They would never have put it on my birth certificate. I was too young and I was too cute. Yeah? I'm the kind that dies from falling out of windows or forgetting how many Seconal I took with how much scotch or forgetting to turn off the gas or hitting bridge pilings at 80 miles an hour or tripping in front of buses. The kind that doesn't look like it's alcohol. And people would say, isn't that too bad? He was so young. But that night I realized a very great truth about myself. I was 31 years old. I was too old for a young, tragic death. It would just be pointless for me to die. And I also realized that my life was over. But I wasn't going to die, and I never want to feel like that again as long as I live. And I said to myself, I wonder if I'm an alcoholic. That's the unbelievable ability we have to overlook overwhelming evidence. Anybody who spent a half an hour with me knew that I was a drunk or I was crazy. Next day I went to work, and there was a woman that I worked with who had 6 years of sobriety, and I'd been watching her for a year. Now I gotta tell you, I try to be the best sober I can be today because I don't know who's watching me, and I gotta tell you, there's somebody watching you. And I watched her for a year. I watched how she moved, I watched how she laughed, I watched how she handled things that were just beyond me. She had good days and bad days, but by God, she had a life that I envied. And that day I was working in real estate. I was in sales. No bosses. Nobody's going to tell me what to do. And we got in a car, It was my turn to drive, to go around and look at the new listings. And I was driving my classic Mercedes. It was an old Mercedes is what it was. And I usually drove around with the windows rolled up so that nobody would know in Southern California that I didn't have air conditioning. So this day we were driving around and there were three other women in the cars. Suzanne and two other women. One of them was an old Irish lady who drank from the time she was 19 until she was in her 70s. And she just had a great time. And the other woman was going through a divorce and she was drinking too much. And they started talking about it. And they started talking about situational drinking and maintenance drinking and alcoholic drinking and non-alcoholic. And, blah, 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 blah. And I thought, if these two women don't shut up, I'm going to go insane. And after it was over, I grabbed Suzanne and I said the last phrase. I said, I'm an alcoholic and I got 20 minutes before I go to pieces. And I said it just like that. And I thank God for the people who have got time in this program who are working the 12th step on a regular basis because she heard the screaming. And she dropped everything. She canceled her appointments that afternoon. She took me to her apartment. She sat me down at her dining room table. She forced me to eat a sandwich. And then she gave me this concoction and I could still taste it today. And occasionally I do it to my new guys. Just because they did it to me. It was orange juice and Karo syrup. And she made me drink two big glasses of it, said it would calm me down. You know what? It did. Some old fart had taught it to her, you know. She told me what Alcoholics Anonymous was. She read to me from chapter 3, chapter 5, and the 12 traditions. I thought, my God, that woman is going to read that entire book to me. And then she told me her story. Now, my story was sleazy, but hers was disgusting. And I thought, my God, if she can stay sober, maybe I can stay sober. It was a 12-step call, you know. We get so few opportunities these days with treatment centers and all that kind of stuff, you know. I mean, a 12-step call is one drunk telling a story to another drunk who's trying to get sober. It's a miraculous thing that happens. If you ever got an opportunity, do not say no, no matter what time or how inconvenient it is, because it is a remarkable, incredible experience. You know? She said she was taking me to a meeting that night, and I told her that I understood it was the alcohol. And I need it. I could not drink anymore. I knew that. It was coming out my pores. I said, what I want to do is I kind of want to drift into sobriety, kind of on a pink cloud of Valium, you know, just kind of touch down. I think Prozac is the Valium of these days. Anyway, that stuff was really great. I just want. And she explained to me in Southern California 19 years ago, and thank God for this woman. She said, in Southern California, we consider sobriety to be clean and sober, one day at a time. I'm really delighted that she said that to me because I probably would have gone on taking drugs and it would have led eventually to drinking, which it always does, and I would have been on that terrible merry-go-round. But it stopped cold that day. And I have not had a drink or a self-administered drug since April 24th, 1974, and I'm deeply grateful for that. There's a lot of problems all over this world about alcoholics and addicts and all that kind of stuff, that there seems to be this great horde of addicts that want to take over Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know why anybody would want to take over this motley crew, for God's sake. I mean, come on. You know, it's a pretty sleazy place to end up in, let's face it. You know, it is not Kiwanis. You know, it's not on my business resume. Is it on yours? I love addicts. I love addicts. You ever talk to them? You got to be a chemist to talk to them. I mean, honest to God. I mean, just figuring out the weights and measures. I mean, the grams and the kilos and all that. Oh, my God. And they were all dealing. I don't know who was buying, but they were all, you know, they were all dealing. Yeah. Unbelievable. Now, if nobody gets nervous about them, if nobody gets excited or jumpy, you know, what happens is whenever I got an addict, they say, come to our open meetings. You know, just come to our, anybody can come, even you. You know? Come and sit down and shut up and listen. You know? And none of those old geezers get up and say, oh, we're going to talk about alcohol around here. What happens is they sit down and they start listening to the causes and conditions.
And they start hearing the language of the heart after a while, you know? And eventually what happens is they want to be part of this. And so what they get is, aha! You know, about a month, they turn into addict alcoholics. Well, as soon as they're, you know, it doesn't matter what attachments you got to the alcoholic thing, they get to read chapter 5, be part of, lead a meeting, you know, maybe get a sponsor and start working the steps. It's just great, you know? And then they become alcoholic addicts. And then what happens is they're at a business meeting, they go to the bathroom, and they get elected GSR. Yeah? And they get into service, and they come to understand their traditions. And they come to understand that tradition 12, that anonymity, is real humility at work. It's where we give up our need to distinguish ourselves, either within this fellowship or outside. And what they become is alcoholics. Now, if you're new, and if you're doing that double identification crap, let me tell you about that stuff, because I did it when I first got here. And there's a lot of interesting titles we've got these days. I mean, some of the identification goes on longer than the talk. Let me tell you, if you're doing that, the only resource in this fellowship that is of any value whatsoever is sober experience. And the ones who have the most of it are the old guys. The ones who are very, very nervous about what's happening about this fellowship. Now, they identify themselves as alcoholics. But if you're running around like I was and making double identification, what I was doing, chapter 3 talks about no one wants to be a real alcoholic. Well, the easiest way not to be a real alcoholic these days is to be an addict. I mean, it's kind of chic. You know, it's got a kind of panache to it, you know? But I get up and say I'm an alcoholic addict or an addict alcoholic. What I'm telling those old guys is my case is a little different from yours, man. I'm a hyper-alcoholic. You know? I'm a little more interesting than you old guys are. And what I'm doing is I'm shutting myself off from the only resource that'll save my life. Because you know what those guys do? You know what those guys do? They're busy. They got lots of people they're sponsoring. They're working with alcoholics. You get to spin around here and call yourself anything you want. But once I said I was an alcoholic, it was very quick. Then suddenly that resource was open. I mean, I don't care about your religious persuasions or your psychological, you know, ramifications or any of that kind of stuff. The only thing is sober experience. So if you're new and you're doing that double identification stuff, cut the crap and join the fellowship. Yeah. There are enough of us around this program that have been around for a while who understand that you can't drink and you can't use drugs. We know that. We're never going to get the literature changed, so just knock off, you know? Yeah! We're not going to change the name of the organization or anything. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous did not change when I arrived. I changed for Alcoholics Anonymous. And you old guys, you old timers with 30 and 35 and 40 and 45 years of sobriety, those of you who are leaving this fellowship because you don't like what the young people are doing to this, I must remind you of the responsibility of the 12th step. You have no right to withhold your sober experience because you don't approve of the way we got here. I've never seen an addict take a one-year cake. If they don't identify, they don't stay. And I desperately need your experience. I desperately need your experience. It's the only thing that keeps us here, keeps us alive. And those of you who drift off to little groups about with people who are just talking like you talk, you miss the resource. We need the newcomers. We need the newcomers to remind us face to face, up front, eyeball to eyeball, exactly where we came from. And if we don't have that, we wither and die. And if you can look around a newcomer's meeting and find five pure alcoholics, good luck. So anyway, I came into this thing stark, staring sober. She took me to my first meeting. It was exactly as I feared it was going to be. It was in a church basement. It had gray walls, a low ceiling. It was filled with smoke, and 400 people that I never would have drank with were there. We had big, huge speaker meetings in California, and thank God of it, because there was a crackling in that room like there is in this one. And it was like being dropped into a shark tank. I'd never seen so many teeth coming at me in my life. You were just real glad to see me. Ha! Keep coming back! Yeah. Walking around. He whispered this weird stuff in my ear. Easy does it. I mean, easy does it. I had fingerprint ink on my fingers, for God's sake, you know? One day at a time. I got a trial in 3 weeks. I was a little jumpy when I first got here. I was coming off of everything. So, you know, I was one of the last of the group that they gave a half a cup of coffee to, because I was lethal. However, I was well-dressed. Now, if some of you are here... I always felt that a blazer was suitable protection from anything. So I was, if any of you are here to get your act together, let me tell you how I arrived. Now I had everything going for me to keep me from arriving at this place. I had a house in the Hollywood Hills, I had a pretty wife, I had a pedigree dog, had a little money, had a classic Mercedes, had a spiffy wardrobe. I'd been paid $300 for a day's work as a model about a week before I got here. I had several national commercials running on television. I always played the nice young man next door. They'd only known what was going on next door. I looked fabulous at my first AA meeting. As a matter of fact, I had a double-breasted blazer, just like that. I walked into my first meeting, and everybody knew that I was a drunk. And I couldn't figure that out. There were two things that were going on that I wasn't aware of, among the other things that I wasn't aware of. One of them was, it was April, and it was a very warm night, and I'd been drinking straight vodka the night before, and I had on a lot of lemon-lime cologne, and I smelled like a gimlet.
What the conclusion?
Just this kind of eau de gimlet, you know? And the other thing was going on that I had newcomer eyes. Now, the only other place I've seen eyes like that, other than on a newcomer in Alcoholics Anonymous, are on a dog loose in a freeway. I was terrified. I didn't know if we were going to have to wear funny hats and sing songs. I didn't know what was going on. And you know what? I didn't care. If that's what we had to do, I didn't wear my funny hat and sung. I didn't care. Whatever I had to do. I was through. I was finished. I had no more ideas. I was out of the game. And you tell me what to do. And thank God you did. I got my sponsor the first night that I was sober. The old timers lie like rugs around here. They talk about rigorous honesty and then they lie through their teeth. Suzanne took me to my first meeting. Sitting next to me was this little guy, and he started talking. And he had done everything that I had done. And a miracle. My first meeting, 400 people, I sat next to the guy who'd done everything that I'd done. A miracle. What I didn't know was, during the 12th step, Suzanne kept jumping up and running out of the room, and I thought she was one of those ones with kidney damage, you know, because she had done a lot of wild stuff. What I did not know was, she was getting up in the room and phoning Jack and telling him my story. Now, Jack sat next to me at my first meeting. The reason his story is exactly the same as mine is he knew every bit of mine. Now, the way that the old-timers get away with that kind of stuff is they say, more will be revealed. It wasn't until I was 3 years sober that I realized I got set up totally, you know. By that time, I was working the 12 steps and everything else. Bonnie came home a week later, and something was different was going on. I was talking about God and the look in their eyes. She thought, oh, yeah. And I said, and there's a place for you too. I will never forget the look on her face. She was just thrilled that there was a place for her. So she went to Al-Anon. And I got to tell you something. Whew. Al-Anon is extraordinary. She's been an active member of Al-Anon for 19 years. Now, an Al-Anon... An Al-Anon is not somebody who's just married to a drunk. An Al-Anon is someone who works the steps and the traditions of Al-Anon, who is active in that fellowship, who is of service, and brings the principles of that program into the house. And I am thrilled that you've done an incredible job on her. She's fabulous. When she came into Al-Anon, she had the lips disappearing and the bitten nails and was angry. And 19 years later, you know what people know her for? Her laugh. Her laugh is like a flock of starlings in a crystal chandelier. It is the most extraordinarily joyous sound that just kind of rips out of her. And every time I hear it, I thank Al-Anon. Because it was the laugh that had disappeared. I'm not even sure it was ever really there. But what a wonderful thing you've given to me. And I'm deeply grateful to Al-Anon for it. Thanks. So we started on this thing. You know, it was really wonderful at first. When I was 6 months sober, I was going to a meeting every night, and my sponsor told me that I had to spend one evening a week at home. It was like a sentence. Now, I had talked to my sponsor, and I had told him that I felt that the best thing that I could do would be to divorce my wife, that we had gone through, there was too much damage, and we had found these programs, and we should go our separate ways. And he said, "You're not going to make any emotional decisions in your first year of sobriety." And I said, "What the hell does that mean?" And he said, "That means you're not going to divorce your wife. You're not going to start going out with anybody else. You're not going to change jobs. You're not going to repaint. You're not going to refurnish. You are not going to quit smoking. You are not going to start jogging 26 miles a day. You're going to put your entire life on hold, and you're going to work the 12 steps, and you're going to get sober, and it takes about a year." And I said, "But you don't understand. I'm not sure that I love her." And he said, "I don't care about love. Work on good manners." So I started saying please and thank you to my wife. It's amazing how much of your relationship can clean up just boom, like that.
Yeah.
But we had a lot of problems. We had to reconstruct a relationship that was very sick to begin with. And you know, a lot of relationships that are formed in sickness don't survive health. But if I had left that relationship, I'd have taken up with somebody who was equally as crazy. And instead of that, by the end of a year, we found out something amazing about ourselves. That we didn't need each other. That we wanted to be together, but we didn't need each other. And that was an amazing thing. I found out years later when we talked for the first time together that she had told her sponsor that she wanted to leave me. And her sponsor in Al-Anon said she had to wait 6 months before she had made any emotional decision. Now, I don't know why Al-Anon's got a 6-month sentence and we get a year, you know. And so it went. Up and down and wild, and I couldn't keep jobs, and I was trying to get sober, and I was just nuts. And, you know, there's a terrible gap between, you know, the working of the steps and when they start to kick in, you know? And God, it was just, you know, how many people here are in their first year of sobriety? How do you like it so far? Right? One of the reasons I stay sober, and there are lots and lots of reasons why I stay sober, but one of the reasons and the main reason I stay sober is that I never want to have to get sober again as long as I live. Yeah. Yeah. It was the worst experience of my adult life. How was it for you? You know, it was like being in a wind tunnel. By the time I was 6 months sober, I was crazier than I'd ever been in my entire life. You know, I had... I was working the steps, talking to my sponsor, and driving people to meetings. I'd been assigned a new best friend named Rich. They give you a new best friend, you know. Rich was my new best friend because Rich couldn't drive and he couldn't talk, and I had a car and couldn't shut up. So they put us together. Rich would sit in the passenger seat going, and I'd drive. And 6 months over, you'd see me driving, you know, you'd see me driving up and down the Hollywood Freeway in my Mercedes with a three-piece suit on, screaming at the top of my lungs, because it's the only thing that would kill the pain. Now, in my first year, I tried to sleep through my entire first year of sobriety. I don't know about you. If I couldn't get loaded, I was going to get out somehow. The entire day of reality was more than I could handle. So I was in sales, so I took lots of naps. And one afternoon, I was trying to take a nap, and I couldn't. I was furious, and I looked up at the ceiling, and I said, this is my first spiritual experience. I said, I don't believe in you, and I think you're a jerk. I cleaned it up because it's an AA meeting. Then it occurred to me, if I didn't believe, who was I yelling at? And then, being a good fall-in-the-way Catholic, I waited for 3 weeks to see if I'd get punished calling him a jerk. But I didn't. I didn't, and a very old concept of God broke and shattered, and I didn't even know it. The idea of a God that was out there and up there, and what started to form in me because of the miracles I heard in Alcoholics Anonymous, which I gathered together like a squirrel gathering nuts, was that somehow there was something going on inside of me, that I had a little microchip of God within me. It's something that the nuns called the soul, but I couldn't hear it from them. All my life, when I was in trouble, I went to moral superiors for help. I went to priests and brothers and nuns and monsignors and psychiatrists and gurus and health food people and chiropractors and doctors and policemen and lawyers and judges. And I explained to them my problem, and they consulted their books and said, this is what you should do about your problem. Well, somebody points a finger at me and tells me what I should do, I tend to bite it off at the knuckle. But I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and you said, this is what I did. Take what you could use. And I couldn't fault that, because it was your experience. It was true for you, and maybe it would be true for me. You know, the problem is with me, and it's a great failing, and I've never gotten over it. I can't learn anything from anybody unless they puke through their nose, you know? Just the way it is. So I have found the solutions to all my problems in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm really grateful that I got struck stupid when I walked in these doors, you know? I mean, I couldn't think of going anywhere else for anything else, any of those other 12-step programs, because my chips were scattered, you know? And if you told me something slightly off, I'd drifted off somewhere. So I've just hung out here. And what I've done is I took the courage from the people who were willing to share their guts from podiums, you know? And I would ask them how to do stuff. I've had a lot of sponsors that I realized. You know, I've learned a lot in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've learned how to be a worker from the workers in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've learned how to be a husband from the husbands in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've learned to be a father from the fathers. I've learned how to be a son. I've learned how to be all those things from you people, because you told me what it was like to be, what was required, what you had to do in order to fulfill those functions, and I listened desperately. One of the things that I hear from people who are going to psychiatrists and all those things, they get up a podium and say, I had this terrible problem, and I checked into treatment, and now I'm okay. And I don't know what happened to you. You're gutting the recovery. I don't know what happened. I need you to get up and tell me what happened. You know? When I was 5 years sober, I was very sober. Things were getting together. I was sponsoring guys. I was talking from podiums. I was Mr. AA. And what I decided to do, and I didn't even know I was doing it because I was so sober, was to test the fence lines of my sobriety, to see just how much rope I had to hang myself. And I did it. And I got arrested again. It's not so much fun sober. I knew the ritual, take off the belt and the shoes. I knew it all. I was released and I went home. Monty walked in from an Al-Anon meeting, and across the room she said, my God, what's the matter? And I told her what had happened, and she didn't start screaming. She didn't start yelling, what have you done to our marriage, what have you done to our lives, none of that thing, because the miracle in Al-Anon had happened in her life. Instead, what she did was she sat down opposite me at the table, and she reached across the table, and she put her hand on my face, and she said, oh, Sean, I'm so sorry that you have to hurt yourself so much. And then she said, I only require two things from you. To be married to you, I require your fidelity and your supportiveness. And if you can't give me those things, then I have to leave you because I love you. But if you can, I will stay because I love you. and I had to make some decisions. And that was the time we started working the traditions in our lives, and we didn't even know we were doing it. My sponsor took me back in depth through the 12 steps. And we also got involved. I also started to work the traditions, and I didn't even know that I was doing them. The traditions seem so separate from our own lives sometimes. But after a time of working the 12 steps over and over and over again, it becomes a time when there's that little thing at the bottom of the 12th step that says, practice these principles in all our affairs. And the only way that I've been able to find how to do that was to personalize the traditions. And so we've done that. When I was 8 years sober and we had put our marriage back together, my daughter was born. Now, you have beautiful and intelligent children. But I have Kate. I was there for her birth. I cut her umbilical cord and I gave her her first bath and lost my heart. And here we were, a family, and we had to do those things. And for our family's welfare should come first, because my recovery is greatly aided by family unity. And so what we had to do is we had to look at what the family was doing. Did we all understand what was going on? What was the dynamic? I was certainly in Alcoholics Anonymous, and while my sobriety came first, I understand that that was supportive, and also that I was supportive of their recovery, of bodies, Al-Anon. You know, that's so easy to make those snide jokes about Al-Anon, and that's not supportive. That's destructive stuff. And I had to stop doing that kind of stuff. And so we had to say, where are we going? What is this family doing? What are our principles and what are our goals? And for our family purposes, there's but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as He may express Himself in our family's conscience. Parents are but trusted servants. They do not govern. We had to rely more and more on a spiritual life. And you understand that we were not, you know, what happened in our family was, and what happens in a lot of alcoholic families, is someone becomes the ultimate authority. It's usually the drunk. You know, it's us imposing our will. You know, God damn it, this is the way we're going to do it. You know? And I had to look at that, whether I was being the ultimate authority or whether I was leading by example. Was I bringing the principles of this fellowship into my own home? Or was I trying to govern, impose my will, instead of looking at the fact that this little unit has three individuals in it? The only requirement for family membership is a desire to be part of that family. Relatives who gather together for mutual support and understanding become part of family. If they don't do that, they remain relatives. And I've got family. Very few of my relatives are my family, and I have an enormous amount of people who are family within this fellowship who understand what I'm doing and what our family is trying to do, and they're supportive of it. And we have to look at each of us as an individual member of this family, and that each has wants and needs. And if it comes a time in our family where a member of it does not agree with what the family is doing, I wonder if I have the courage to ask them to leave. Or if my family goes off on a tangent that has nothing to do or is dangerous to my sobriety, do I have the courage to remove myself? I've never had to make that decision yet, and I never hope it happens. Every family member should be autonomous except in matters affecting the family or AA or the rest of the family as a group. We're very autonomous in our family. We sit down and talk about decisions that we're going to make. When we were to move to Vancouver 5 years ago, what we did was we flew Kate and Bonnie up, and we looked around Vancouver. And we went to all the places that were around, and we explored the city, and we said, the three of us sat down at the end of it and said, do we really want to do this? And we all said, yeah, we really want to do, you know, because it was necessary for Kate to be comfortable coming to a foreign country. It was necessary for Bonnie, who was born in America, to understand that she was coming to another country, and would she be comfortable with it? And she said yes. And so we did that. Our family has but one primary purpose, to be mutually supportive of each other, and that's what we try to do. We try to encourage each other without being domineering, to make it possible for each other to grow and become who we want to be. I've got to look at, am I supportive of Bonnie's Al-Anon program? Am I supportive of any way that somebody wants to recover, whether it's inside or outside of these programs? Our family ought never endorse, finance, or lend the family name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose, and our primary purpose is a spiritual purpose. And I've got to look whether I'm committing my family to things that they have no say in, you know? And I did a lot of that at the beginning of the sobriety. Say, all right, we're all going here, and this is what we're going to do. Never bothered to ask anybody if they wanted to do that. And I've got to do that. I've got to do that, you know? So many of us want to make up for lost time. And a lot of times when the disease is stopped in its forward motion, what happens is it starts manifesting itself in other weird behavior. And one of the things is workaholism. We're going to make up for all that lost time. And you get diverted into money, property, and prestige. If I get enough stuff together, I'll be okay. And what that does is it moves the family in that direction. It can't help it. And a lot of problems arrive. That's why it's necessary for sponsorship before making these kind of decisions to talk them over. To understand exactly that what I do affects the people around me. That I am not one human being. And I am not the center. You know, so many alcoholic families concentrate on the one problem person. And the one problem person is the alcoholic. And after a while of being sober, enough is enough. I got to look around and say, wait a minute. We're the forgotten ones in the family. We're the kids who have never made any noise whatsoever, who are desperately lonely or frightened. We're the ones who have taken over control of this family and let them relieve some of their burdens. We're all those kind of things. I've got to look at that so it's even. Every family ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. You know, I must be financially responsible. I must be. Is my grandiosity or my immaturity putting our family in some kind of financial danger? I've got to look at that, and I have at times. One of the things in the first couple of years that kept me, kind of would calm me down, is going shopping. I'd go buy 3 shirts when I needed one. I bought something new. It made me feel better for a minute. And that was putting us in danger because we were in rocky times. And I got to look at that. We've got to be self-supporting. If I borrow money from somebody to help my family, do I have a plan that we agree on to pay that guy back? Is it a contract that we both understand, or is it one of those open-ended things where it's ridiculous? If I have to take government support to help my family, am I doing everything that I can figure out to do to become employed? And I've got to look at those kind of things. And is everybody in my family emotionally self-supporting? Are they real human beings? Have they remained crippled? Is there something that needs to be done to help them? Our family should remain forever non-professional, but we may employ special workers. Is my arrogance telling me that I am the only one that can make the decisions for the family? Have I become all-knowing? You know? Have I become the governor? Or do I have enough humility to understand that there are some areas that I have no experience with and that we've got to refer problems to doctors and sometimes to psychiatrists and financial advisors and lawyers and those kind of things who can take care of specific things? I don't know everything in my world, and I've got to be humble enough to do that. Now, our family ought never be organized, but we do have responsibilities to each other. And our family should be based on freedom to express ourselves, but also mutual responsibility. Kate's 11 years old, and you should see her bedroom. And Bonnie and I have been having a little trouble with that. And finally, what we came up with is our own rooms are our own responsibility, but the common rooms in the house are all our responsibility. We got to keep that neat. So we talked to Kate about that, and we said, listen, you can live however you want to live in your room. I've got a guy that I sponsor is a great friend of mine. I was telling him about this and about Kate's room, and he said, listen, does the condition of Kate's room affect the property value of your house? And I said, well, no. And he said, well, then it's not really dirty. I have 2 teenage sons. So what we've done is we made this deal where Kate can keep her room any way she wants, except if she's going to have a sleepover or go to somebody's sleepover. But the common rooms, the living room, the dining room, the kitchen, the den, is something that we all got to take care of. And we've all got those individual responsibilities, and I can learn from that kind of stuff. We have no opinion on outside issues, hence our family name ought never be drawn into public controversy. We have no opinion on anybody's way of life. Anybody else's. You know, there's so many times you hear that in AA about us and the normies. And I really hate that. You know why? The normies don't need to work the 12 steps. I do. They don't. We're not enemies. That's ridiculous. We have a philosophy here of live and let live, and that's what I'm trying to do. So we've got no opinion on anybody's race, creed, color, anything like that. That's not my responsibility. And if by chance I'm going to become a public figure of some kind of getting into a political race or making some kind of stand on some kind of issue, I've got to sit down with my family and say, this is what I'm going to do. And our family name is going to be brought into this. Does everybody approve? And if they don't approve, then I have to make it very clear, if I embark on something, then I make it very clear to everybody else that I'm talking as an individual, that I do not represent anybody else in my family. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. And we need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and television. I'm in a media business. And I have no right to break my anonymity, because if I break my anonymity, I break my wife and my daughter's anonymity. At one point, when Bonnie was in public information in Southern California, she was invited to go on the Today Show. And she came to me and said, "My being on there, if anybody knows us, will break your anonymity. Is that all right?" Anytime that she's working with a new Al-Anon, she said, "Is it all right if I break your anonymity?" Which, of course, is ridiculous. It doesn't matter to me at all, but I really appreciate being asked. I really appreciate being asked, and I always ask her, too. And she went on the Today Show and told them how to light it. So she was all backlit, and nobody could tell who she was anyway, except somebody where she works said, "I need to talk to you. My husband drinks too much." And anonymity is the spiritual foundation of our family, never reminding us to place principles before personalities. And I have to look at what my principles are. And am I walking like I talk? You know, it's real easy to stand up here in Toronto and look fabulous. I mean, I've got my little red tie on, and I look neat, you know? But how do I look in my den? How do I look in my bedroom? How do I look in my front yard with my neighbors? Am I practicing these principles there? And I try on a daily basis to do that. And the anonymity thing is that I give up my right to distinguish myself. I was always trying to make myself different because I felt different. And now I don't need to do that. Now I'm a neighbor, you know? Now I'm a worker. Now I'm a taxpayer. Now I'm a member of a community. And I walk like I talk most of the time, except for the freeways. I don't want you to think I'm perfect. But I got to tell you, I don't really come to alcohol. And people say, "You know, you've been here a while. Why do you come to these meetings?" I got to tell you, I come to here because I hear a lot from people taking first birthday cakes. I don't know. There's something that happens at the moment you take a first birthday cake that never happens again. It's just amazing. There's this incredible kind of intense gratitude and just enough wisdom to have these enormous kind of insights. And I love it. I love it. I come to, you know, when I was new and I still do it, I would kind of sidle up to the coffee machine where the old timers were standing and kind of listen to them and hope they didn't notice that I was there, you know, it's a get lost kid, you know. And there are people in this program who saved my life who didn't even know I was standing behind them. And first year things, God, they're just amazing. One of the things was, I heard this girl in Hollywood, God, she was a mess. She had spiked hair and a leather jacket on and torn tights and big boots and a safety pin through her nose. I mean, this was a serious, serious punk. And she said what she had found out in her first year of sobriety, that she had always demanded that her parents approve of her. And she did everything to make it hard for them to do that. But it was a test for them, and then she realized that she had never approved of them, and that she needed to approve of them. And she was working on that. And because of that, they were starting to approve of her. It's absolutely amazing. This little girl got up one time in her first year cake and said, "Now, I've been trying for 19 years to tell my guys about staying in the now. You know, one day at a time, right here, you know, doing that." And this little girl got up and said, "My sponsor told me just to be where my hands are." And I went, ah, you know. I was down in Fort Worth, Texas. We were down there for a meeting, and it was, if you ever get a chance to go to Texas to AA meetings, go. They are wonderful. Texans love this language, and they put together stuff in an incredible way. And all that southern charm when it's real is just amazing. And one girl at an open meeting where they were sharing said, "The reason we tell newcomers not to make any plans is we're afraid that's all they'll get." I love that. I just loved it. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I absolutely love it. I learn from everybody. I learn from my daughter. My wife is a very nervous driver. Whenever there's a strange sound in the car, she reacts badly to it. Now, I've been telling her, "That's ridiculous. You got to work your program and overcome these fears, you know? You know, it's just irrational fears, and I refuse to be dominated by them anymore." My daughter was 2 years old, sitting in the back seat, and she dropped over. She had a thing of apple juice, and she dropped it down and made a strange sound. And what she said before Bonnie could react was, "It's me, Mom." She didn't say, "Don't get upset. It's really irrational. Don't do any of that kind of stuff." She said, "It's me, Mom." So that's what I do now. Whenever I do something that startles her, never surprise an Al-Anon. Never surprise. They've been surprised enough. You know? I just say, "It's me. It's me that's making the noise. It's me that's doing the thing." There's a girl in one of our groups. And she had a few years of sobriety. And this is learning from the newcomers, because we need you guys. And she's a very bubbly kind of lady. She's just wild. I just love her. She came into meeting one day, and she looked very fragile and very, very subdued. And I said, "What's the matter?" And she said, "Oh, I've just been to the doctor, and they did some tests." And I said, "What kind of tests?" She said, "Well, it was kind of." I said, "What kind of test?" I had enough sobriety that I scared her. And she said, "Well, they did a biopsy." I said, "Oh, how'd it come out?" She said, "Well, not good." I said, "What does not good mean?" And she said, "It's malignant." I said, "Okay, what does that mean?" And she said, it means it's a malignancy. And I said, "What the hell is a malignancy?" And she said, "It's cancer." I said, "Ah, now you've said the word. Now it's gone down in size a little." So I said, "If you're asked to share from a podium tonight, you get up there, and don't you tell me any of that happy horse shit. You get up there and talk about what's going on with you today." So that night they asked her to share. She got up and said, "Hi," and she started doing that. I was sitting down in the front row, and I went, and she said, "I've just been diagnosed with cancer, and I'm terrified," and she started to cry. She got down from the podium, and after the meeting, five women came from five different parts of the meeting and just surrounded her, and they walked with her for the next 4 or 5 months. I saw them. They were always kind of together, you know. It was amazing. Shortly thereafter, I had one of the most notable successes of my life. It was an incredible event in my life. It was just remarkable. And I went to the doctor. And I came to the meeting that night, and she was there. And I said, "You remember that stuff I told you about a month ago?" And she said, "Yeah." I said, "Tell it back to me, because I've just been diagnosed with a rather serious skin cancer." And she said, I had a biopsy and it was positive. And she said, "What was it?" And I said, "It's skin." She said, "Skin what?" I said, "Skin cancer." She said, "Fine, you've said the word now." Punk newcomer. She said, "If you're asked to share tonight, don't give them any of that happy horse shit. Get up and tell them what's going on." They asked me to share. I got up and said, "My name is Sean, and I'm an alcoholic. And I've just been diagnosed with skin cancer, and I'm terrified." And I sat down. And from five different corners of the room, five guys came, just moving. And they told me about their skin cancer thing. One of them had the same thing 30 years ago, and I mean the whole, and they walked with me. They kept checking in with me, "How you doing?" You know. So I went and had the thing down on the side of my face, and then another one on the side of my face. And, you know, they check me over pretty regularly now. You know, whenever they find anything weird, they take the melon scoop out and just, it's gone, you know. My body's starting to look like a railroad map of New Jersey, but I've had to give up my day job as stripogram. But I keep close to those guys, and we talk to each other, because that's what Alcoholics Anonymous is about. I share the festivals of my life from the podiums of Alcoholics Anonymous. I tell you the good news and the bad news, and you tell it back to me. Ivars Lusis committed suicide as a freshman in college. And I'd heard about Danny. He had a government job, and his co-workers had bought him towels and soap because he smelled so bad. He wasn't taking care of himself. And the year that I got sober in 1974, he overdosed on heroin. He was a dealer. He used to ride around on his motorcycle. And I went to a class reunion 2 or 3 years ago, and there's always someone there who knows what's happened to everybody, you know. I loved the reunion. I was sober, and I was the thinnest and had the most hair of my class. It was great. And so they brought me on brought me up today. And I said, "What about Lou Fletcher?" And somebody said, "Oh, Lou, he died of cirrhosis of the liver 2 years ago. Lou, who didn't need to drink." And here I am. I'm sober. I'm clean. I'm married to a woman who likes me. I have a beautiful daughter. I have exciting work. I've just started my own new business. I've got everything beyond my dreams. Beyond my dreams. I have a God that I'm comfortable with. I have everything. And the reason I have everything is based on the fact that I try on a daily basis to expand my spiritual condition. I'm service in Alcoholics Anonymous. From the first day, I emptied ashtrays and washed cups. And I do that kind of thing. I've been GSR, VCM, alternate delegate for Southern California. I'm asked to do this kind of thing, and I got to tell you, if you think this is a big deal, let me tell you, this is the least important 12-step work there is, talking from a podium in a strange town. The most important 12-step work is the kind that you do. The kind that you do when you get an opportunity, almost, hopefully, a lot of times, which is when one drunk sits down and tells his story to another drunk who's trying to get sober. That's the highest form. I got to tell you, I am real, real grateful to be here. I'm really grateful to be asked. I love you very much. And there's a song that a Canadian artist sings. It's Canadian written, and the artist is Annie M. And she sings about her hometown, and I paraphrase it a little because I think it means to us. And now I'll conclude with the wish you go well. Sweet be your dreams and your happiness swell. Now we must leave for our journey begin. I've loved being with you. I hope to be with you. I pray I'll be with you again. God bless you.